Hello, and welcome to the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. I'm Carl from selfsufficienthub.com, and I'm here to talk about all things self-sufficiency, all things homesteading, and about how we can reduce the gap between our consumption and our production. Sustainability and food security matters. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 382 of the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. I hope you're all safe and well. Today, I have with me returning regular guest, Alan from the Homesteading UK podcast, almost called it the Urban Homesteading UK podcast. It's great to have you with you. How are you doing, Alan?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, mate. And you?
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Good. It's really nice to speak to you again after, well, actually only been a few days, isn't it, since we managed to meet up. I must thank you again for your kind hospitality in looking after me and my family and feeding us so well the other night. Really great food, really great company, really appreciate it. So thank you. Yes.
Absolute pleasure. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the geography of me and Alan, basically, we both live on the south coast of the UK, or near the south coast of the UK. I live over towards the west, and Alan lives right on the east side. We're about, what is it, Alf? 3.5-4 hours apart, or more than that?
Without traffic the other night, it was just over 3 hours, like 3 hours, 3 minutes or something, which was fantastic. There was no traffic, managed to get back. Really good. Yeah,
Alan was actually holidaying past my house another few hours, so he stopped in on his way home to break up the journey, and it was lovely to see you.
Yeah, it was really fantastic. We'd intended to stop and just, you know, we were going to stay somewhere for the night, a bit like we did last year when we managed to meet up, and then decided, you know, we just fancy being home. So rather than booking another night, we just came straight back from yours, and like I say, got back just after midnight. So it worked out really well. So thank you.
No trouble. And it gave me the opportunity to do something that I love to do, but I very rarely get the chance to do. And that is to have a homesteader in my house. And I was able to do things like share some of my milk and water kefir grains with you, because that's not something you'd had before.
Well, that's amazing. So thank you for that. What I actually did was the next morning I got up and did what you suggested to get them going again.
Yeah,
and then left them on the counter for 48 hours, and left the milk kefir on the counter for 48 hours, and thought I'd killed it, but I think it's going to be all right. It's just been so warm, and it just, you said, oh, a couple of days on the top, or a day on the top is about a week or whatever it was. So I was like, and then I got busy, and oh, that'll be all right till the morning, and then I looked at it, and it all kind of curdled, and it looked pretty grim actually, all the whey had separated out, and. But I managed to strain it through, and actually the kefir looks good now. Hopefully that's going to be fine.
Yeah, I think with all of these grains, for anyone listening, this is a bit of a troubleshooter for all of you guys. Well, not a troubleshooter, but just a way of thinking. When it comes to all of these things, so milk kefir, water kefir, kombucha scobies, but also your sourdough starter. If you think about how these things actually came into existence millennia ago, they were kind of made through pure happenstance, and they're really, really quite robust. Now, I think that's not to say that you can't mismanage them and you can't end up with a poor product. But what I'm trying to say is you'd have to work fairly hard and be extra neglectful to actually kill them to the point that you couldn't just recuperate them with a mix or two. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one I can liken it to best is the sourdough, because obviously I've been doing that for quite some time. And like you say, you can leave that alone for weeks on end and still manage to revive it. In the fridge, at least, anyway. I've left it sort of 3 weeks, 4 weeks in one case, I think, where I managed to just to see if I could, see if it would revive. I did it just as a little experiment, and it did after 4 weeks. So, they need looking after, but not as diligently, perhaps, as people think. Just to keep them alive, if you want them to be effective and to work really well and make good bread and all that, then I think probably they do need a bit more care. But yeah, like you say, you have to try pretty hard to kill them off.
Yeah, for sure. And the same as with the sourdough, you know, with the milk kefir, and I'm sure you haven't, but if you did do something that, you know, affected that particular batch, you left it way too long or whatever, then, you know, you just need to go through the process of feeding and, you know, that whole cycle two or three times, and boom, you're right back to square one again and ready to go, just like with sourdough. I love that about these products.
That's good to know, because I there will be times when I just don't get a chance to get around to it, so it will be nice to know that you can you know, leave it a little bit and you can still get it back on track again. That's helpful. But yeah, with the sourdough, obviously I'm used to that, but with the kefir, that's a completely new thing to me. So, and the water kefir is completely new. I've literally heard of that first time about 6 weeks ago. I've never heard of it before then.
Wow.
I've heard of the milk one. I'd even tried some and someone I knew had tried to make some, and, you know, but the water kefir was literally, yeah, 6 weeks, a couple of months ago was the first time I even heard of it being in existence. So,
great. Well, keep me updated with your progress. Let me know how you get on with it.
Well, I'm planning to drink some today. I've got some sitting in the fridge with some little sticks of ginger in it, and I'm going to, in the sunshine this afternoon, sit and have a go. So, yeah, I'll keep you posted.
Perfect. Mm. So, you just mentioned that you've obviously just got home from holiday, mate, and stopped in on your way through. So I am curious, because we've had such hot weather here, I'm curious what your garden looks like after being not quite abandoned, because you've had a little bit of help while you're away, but what it looks like after being left without you, its main guardian, for a week or no more than a week of this really hot weather. And just run me through the winners and losers over your holiday. What's happened while you're away?
There's been no major dramas, to be honest with you. There was a wigwam of beans that I'd put in my garden. I tried to get an extra wigwam of cobra beans into the garden, and they've completely failed. That's been a complete loss. I think that the soil in my garden's pretty poor. It's not home. This is, which is, we live on chalk, so there's probably a centimetre or two of topsoil, and then the rest of it's pretty much chalk underneath that. And where it's not, it's just been mixed up together by people digging it before, and it's just really very dry. And we haven't had any rain here for, going back to May probably.
Yeah.
Any meaningful rain. And so it's been so dry. And so the garden's pretty dry. And obviously the little bit of watering that you do, you know, doesn't really touch the sides. I do a thing, as you know, I teach a bit of horticulture at school where I work. And I've got this thing that I do when I teach the boys how to water plants. And pretty much you give them a watering can or a hose or whatever you do with the sprinkler on the a rose attachment on the end. And right, water that till you think it's done. And most people will just sort of spray a bit of water on the top, and then you go across, it's good, yeah. And then you put your finger in the soil and you just run it down just half a centimetre deep into the soil. And it's, you know, typically, especially now, I mean, you wouldn't be able to do it even probably in my garden at least. It's dust underneath. And so the amount of watering that we actually need to do is significantly more than most people realise. Yeah. And so the bit that I've been doing in the garden at home hasn't touched the sides, to be honest. The allotment, however, has survived beautifully. I was really amazed. I went up there for probably, I don't know, an hour or so on the day that we got back, on the morning after we got back. And actually, I've had a bit of help with the watering. My mum was very kind to sort of pop in and do a bit. But again, you know, it takes an hour, a good hour, to water that properly.
Yeah.
She won't have done that in the time. She might have done, you know, some of the beds or whatever. But in fact, it survived really well. And I think some of it's been mulched really well. A lot of it is in really good sort of humus compost and chicken spoil and that sort of stuff. The other thing to remember as well, Carl, is that I tend to grow crops that like this sort of weather in the summertime particularly.
Yeah.
But the only real losers that I've had, have been things that were struggling before it went away anyway. So, you know, like I've had a real problem getting carrots going this year. I've had a real problem getting the lettuce going this year. And in actual fact, the seedlings that I've got in pots, very kindly my neighbours and my mum's looked after them for me while I've been away, and they're now looking really healthy, almost ready to go out. So there's been no real losers. The tomatoes in the greenhouse I was a bit worried about, but I changed the way that I did that this year. Remember, we spoke last year, didn't we? We did a podcast about this time last year where you asked me about preparing for a holiday.
Yeah.
And I reflected on that after we'd spoken about it. And then when I did the tomatoes this year, I've done them completely, well, not completely, but quite differently, in that rather than them being in a kind of a closed system now, whereas last year they were in, I had bags of compost on the ground, and I'd cut holes in the tops of the bags, and I'd set in 10 litre pots into the tops of the bags, and I planted, can you still hear me there?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I planted into them. What happened there, obviously, is I've got a bag with a pot on top and a tomato plant in it, and whatever water I put into that system is all the water that system's getting. It's in a greenhouse, it's indoors.
Yeah.
Not going to get any rain. And so I changed this year, and I just dispensed with the bags. And actually, both of my greenhouses have got soil bases. They've got, you know, bricks around the bottom, which one of them's fixed in and the other one's not. But bricks around the bottom to hold the frame down. And then inside, it's just soil anyway.
Yeah.
It's like, well, why would I put a bag down on that? It's just mad. So I've put a very loose frame in this year just to see if it would work. Just some loose bits of timber with maybe a couple of screws to hold it together. And then I've just put loads of compost around the edges of that. And then I've planted that pot into that compost on the ground.
Yeah.
And that system, with obviously the watering, and we can't use hoses here now, but watering into that system seems to have worked a lot better. I've still had a few problems with blossom end rot, which I tend to get in the greenhouse because, you know, when you get really hot spells like this, the temptation is always to go and water more than you need to, or more frequently than you need to. But actually, it's worked really well. So I've been away for, I don't know what it was, 10 days or so. And I've completely come out unscathed, so I'm feeling pretty good about things.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. And it's lovely to hear, actually, that the conversation we had last year about the tomato, because I remember it quite distinctly, because
yeah,
obviously I've never used grow bags for my tomatoes. So it's lovely to hear that change has helped and made a difference, because it seemed to me that it made sense, you know?
Well, what I did was... Because last year, if you recall, we were away for slightly longer. I think it was about 17 nights we were away for, 16 nights, something like that. And obviously, that does change things, because that's two waterings, realistically, for tomatoes. If you say that I water them about every 6 or 7 days, which I would normally do here. So that the fact that it's a longer period does change it, because you're looking at two waterings. Whereas with it being just the one this time, I was able to say to my mum, look, any chance you could pop in at the weekend, you know, whichever day you can do, and just give them all a really good soaking, and then they'll be fine.
Yeah.
And she was on the text to me, oh, well, but it's been really hot here. Mum, it'll be fine. Don't worry, they'll be fine. Give them a really good soaking, it'll be all right. Whereas last year, because we were away for that long, and I wasn't able to rely on necessarily people being able to water, I'd set up an automated system, if you remember.
Yeah, I do. And it didn't go particularly well, did it?
It didn't go at all well. No, it's been ages trying to figure it out. And yeah, I got there in the end, but it still wasn't ideal. And yeah, it wasn't great. So this way, I think, was better. I think if we'd been away for a fortnight, it might have been a different problem, particularly with this weather we've had these last few days.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I say, I was able to give them a good soak the night before I went, get my mum to go in at the weekend while we were away. And then when I came home, you know, the first thing I did when I got out was go and give them another good soak. And they've been absolutely fine.
Good stuff.
Starting to get a good crop off that now as well, which is really, really good.
Yeah, yeah. So you've mentioned a couple of things that I want to explore with you. And so we'll jump back a little bit in time. You've mentioned that you grow crops that like this type of weather, and I want to get to that. But before we do, you've said that you're on chalk. Now, where I grew up as a child, we were on chalk, but I wasn't doing any gardening then, so I don't really have any experience with it. And I'm just wondering, you've mentioned the difference between your soil in your garden and the soil at the allotment. Is your allotment also on chalk? And is the difference, therefore, that it's been, you know, you've added organic matter year after year? Is that the only difference between the two?
The difference is cultivation, yeah. So in the garden at home, I tend to grow ornamentals. And what that tends to mean realistically for me, because, you know, life's busy, is that I've got some nice shrubs. And I've got a few perennial plants that will come back year after year that flower, like dahlias and that kind of thing. But mostly it gets kind of weeded and maybe mulched. And other than that, and a bit of pruning, it gets left alone.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that the soil, because it's chalk, you know, there'll be plenty of your listeners that are gardening on chalk as well, I imagine. It drains really, really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Means it gets dry really, really quickly. But when it gets dry, rather than going dusty like some soils will, it kind of bakes into this kind of brick. And so when I do have to plant into it, I kind of dread it a bit, because it's like, well, there's no use me using a trowel. I'm going to have to get a mattock out and properly spring it and like try and smash it up a bit. Whereas at the allotment, it's very much imported soil. So my allotment is, I imagine, west-facing, something like that. It's on a slope, which makes, obviously, you know, drainage on chalky slopes is, you know, like there's no water there at all.
Yeah.
So it's kind of been terraced, it has been terraced into five strips, if you like, of five raised beds. So if you can imagine, down the side of this is not particularly steep, but steep enough hill. I've got pairs of strips of raised beds, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then I've got an odd one at the end. So I've got five rows, if you like, of five beds side by side along the side of this hill as you go down it. Yeah. And what I've done there then is, because I've got these raised beds on the side of a hill, is I need to find some soil from somewhere. Obviously, the soil that's there has been well cultivated over years. I don't know how long the plot's been there, but, we're going back to the Second World War probably. Yeah. It's right in the middle of town, so it's at least that old, I would imagine. So it's been well cultivated over years and years. And what I've done then is I've put this terraced effect on top with the raised beds, and then I've just filled the beds up. Some of that's been with soil that was there initially, at least. But a lot of it was with, compost that I'd grown or imported or manure or spoil from the chicken house or whatever. And now what I've gone over to in the last couple of years is this raised bed into these, no dig into the raised beds.
Yeah.
Where I put the soil in initially, I now don't dig anymore and I absolutely need to. So it will be mulch it 4 to 6 inches, whatever I've got mulch wise, plant into that. And then we go from there. And one of the reasons the carrots have struggled is that some of my compost is not quite as well finished as I'd like it to be, but it's what I had available at the time, so that went on. And I think the carrots are struggling to find purchase.
Right, so it's all a bit loose.
Yeah, some of it's a bit loose. Some of it could be composted down a bit more. I've got a lot of stuff coming out of, like, we've got guinea pigs now as well, so there's a lot of wood shavings in there, a lot of straw. And so some of it, it takes a bit longer to compost down, but when it's near enough there, I'll just use it if it's needed as almost as a mulch. And then sometimes I end up going, oh, I want to sow into that. And of course, by then it's too late.
Yeah.
It's already on the bed. So I think that's probably where the carrots have struggled. But still, I think if you were to dig underneath now, the stuff that I've put on top, I think potentially you'd find it's pretty hard underneath the ground. It used to be quite hard work digging it. It's one of the reasons I moved over to the no dig, because it was quite hard digging it. Hard work digging it.
Yeah,
especially in dry summers like this.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir there. Obviously, I hate digging. I'm not digging anything.
I quite enjoy digging, actually. I have to say, I do quite miss it. It's quite a good workout as well, but it has saved me hours and hours of time. So
Yeah. Well, if ever you miss digging so much, you just let me know, because I've always got something to do at work. You can always come and dig a trench for me.
No, that sort of digging is no fun.
Yeah, no, I get more than my fair share away from the garden.
Yeah, I can imagine.
go on.
I was just going to say, what I've been really pleased about was that one of the things I was really concerned about going over to the no dig was the couch grass at the allotment.
Yeah.
Because if you can imagine the allotment, it's basically a big grid, and around the edge of each of the grids is a grass border. And in each of those grass borders are various weeds, but the most pernicious of which is the couch grass that we get out there. And that sends kind of runners underground, and they'll pop up everywhere, even in places you think, how on earth has it got to there? And I was really concerned about going over to no dig with that, because I couldn't imagine that no dig would solve the problem.
Yeah.
And so far it's not been too bad. There's one or two spots where the beds are perhaps a bit lower, and they're not quite so deep where it's managing to get in, but where the beds are really deep with the board, the physical barrier of the sort of gravel board that I've used around the edges of the raised beds. And then obviously the compost and piling it up really high. It seems to, at the moment, at least fingers crossed, slowed it down, if not stopped it altogether in most places. So I've been really pleased with the outcome of that.
That's great. And I fight bindweed. I fought bindweed on the last property, and I'm fighting it here. And I still get it in my no dig bed, but I think I'd get a lot more of it if I was just to cultivate the ground in a more old fashioned method, I think.
I think with bindweed, trying to dig it out is a losing battle, and in fact potentially it makes the problem worse, because theoretically, it's possible that you cut through the roots and make two plants out of one all the time.
Yeah.
And so actually just hoeing it off has always been a more sensible option. And in fact, we get two different types of bindweed at the allotment. We get kind of the large leaved bindweed that people would be familiar with the white flowers.
Yeah.
And then they get this kind of, I think it's called field bindweed, which grows very, very low to the ground. It's much less robust. It's much slower growing. Which is, I can kind of live with that one, but it's the one that climbs up through everything. That's a pain.
Yeah.
But with the no dig, I need to go up and do a bit of hoeing at some point. I've got a little bit behind with that, but if you just hoe it off, it solves the problem.
Yeah, for sure.
So much easier. Easier to do with the mulch, hoeing through chalk soil at this time of year, with baked dry like it has been, is a pain.
Yeah, virtually impossible.
Yeah, almost impossible. With a no dig now, it's like, yeah, no problem. I just, you know, it's nice and loose on the top. I just hoe through that, job done.
Ideal. Ideal. So yeah, going back to the second thing that you mentioned, that I wanted to dig into, you said that you tend to grow crops that like this weather. So what does that look like?
Well, I'm not really particularly a traditional eater. I think people that listen to our podcast will know that Mike's a meat and two veg kind of guy, and I like other things.
Yeah, Team Tasty versus Team Taters.
That's the one. Yeah. Team Tasty versus Team Taters. So my thing is very much about growing things, I suppose, that like a Mediterranean climate. I tend to like a Mediterranean, North African, or even South American kind of diet, typically. It doesn't mean so we don't eat a roast every week, because we probably do. But if I could have pasta, I'd choose that over mash and gravy most of the time, especially this time of year. Yeah. And so it's things that are going to go in there that are going to enjoy this weather tend to be things that come from Mediterranean climate. So I've got beans, I've got sweet corn, I've got courgettes, I've got Cavolo Nero, which doesn't mind this heat either. What else have I got in there? Loads of tomatoes. I mean, everyone that listens to us knows that's my thing. And so they're all crops that tend to enjoy this heat. And I suppose probably 40% of the allotment's over to that, or to permanent fruit at the moment. And then the rest is kind of crops that I'm just trying to sort of nurse through this real heat. So, you know, the winter brassicas that are now in, the leeks that are in, you know, those kinds of things that are not so keen on the heat, just trying to nurse them through. And that's partly using the shade that some of those other plants that will provide, because they tend to mostly be quite tall growing, to shade out through the hottest part of the day, those plants that don't like it so hot, as best as I can.
Yeah.
I've probably got, I don't know, maybe two beds of sweet corn, two of tomatoes, three of beans, one of courgette, something like that, up at the allotment at the moment. And okay, they love this heat. They love it.
So whenever I always, as you will know, but perhaps listeners won't, I think of you as my sort of vegetable growing guru, and you're way more experienced in it than I am. And you know, if I do have a question that isn't solved by a quick Google search, or if I'm just a bit panicked about something, you're the guy that I text a photo to and say, help me, what do I do with this? And particularly, and I don't know why, but I think of that when I think about brassicas, because I think it's because you always talk about purple sprouting broccoli. So I'm just wondering what you and so that's why my ears kind of pricked up when you said crops that like this weather is what you tend to be growing, because I always imagine that you're growing lots and lots of brassicas all the time. Is that not the case at the moment?
It's true enough, with mixed success, because the heat and the dry weather. But I tend to be growing brassicas for next year. If we've got a cabbage now, unless it shreds nicely and makes a good coleslaw, or you know, I can make some sort of a salad out of it, I'm probably not going to eat it.
Right.
That's the reality. And so there's no point me growing that. That's a waste of time. So I've got, I think, probably at the moment, two beds of purple sprouting broccoli, one that's kind of mixed Brussels sprouts and red cabbage. I've got the last of the summer cabbages that are coming through, which are greyhound, which do shred quite nicely, actually. And then I've got a bed of summer sprouting, which has been dreadful. And then one of, what's the other thing I put in? That might be winter cabbages I've put in already, actually. I think the other one. And right. So that's all my brassicas. So what, six beds of brassicas, something like that? Which is maybe a quarter of the whole allotment, but most of it's for Christmas through till maybe April, something like that.
Yeah. And have you struggled with that in the heat?
Yes. Not so much for the winter cropping.
Yeah.
So the purple sprouting broccoli and the Rudolph that I've got in for sort of cropping over wintertime and early spring seem to be doing okay. Where I've struggled is I put some green sprouting in for the summer, and that's bolted effectively. They never got big enough, and then the heat's come along and it's just gone, okay, we're not going to grow anymore. We're just going to try and produce flower.
Yeah.
And obviously when you're doing sprouting broccoli, what you want is the flower buds before the flowers open.
Yeah.
If it bolts, that's kind of good because you get them quicker, but it's not because you don't get the crop. And often the crop's not very tasty anyway. It tends to go a bit woody sometimes, or, you know, a bit limp. It's not great. So that's been a waste of that bed's been wasted this year. Complete loss, really. I've had a few spears that have been worth eating, but that's been it. But to be fair, some of that is my own fault because I put it in a bit late. I'd put some overwintering garlic in the bed, and the garlic came out early because obviously it had been a really good spring and that had grown really well. And then I put the sprouting broccoli in straight afterwards, and it's just been too hot. It's not cooked at all.
Yeah, because I've lost pretty much all of my summer heading broccoli. We got like you say, we got some off of it. We got enough for a meal for the whole family, but that was all from six plants. So that was a bit disappointing. And I noticed just yesterday one of my cauliflowers has started bolting, so I'm going to probably have to harvest all of those a bit early as well now.
Yeah, I was at the allotment the other day, and it's what's nice about being at the allotment is you get to see what other people are doing. And I noticed that my neighbour, and I know they're very attentive because I see them up there often, but they had actually grown some beautiful cauliflowers, and I've never managed to do that in all my years of gardening. Every time I have them, they bolt. It's really hard to get a cauliflower to head up properly, and they've done a really good job of doing that on the neighbouring plot. I think a lot of it was to do with use of shade netting, just to try and keep the heat off, which they've now taken away, I noticed, but that might be because of other crops that are in there. But yeah, you can see what other people are doing and what's been working as well, which is really nice. You just have to wander around and just see what people are up to. It's a good way of learning.
Yeah, I like that. I like that way of thinking. So to me, it feels in August, this really feels like a huge transition in the garden, because I feel like we're kind of, everything's about to change. So while we're still, you know, in and, you know, massively in our main crop season, obviously, I feel like all of our forward thinking and everything we're doing towards the future is right now changing, because we're no longer, or I say no longer, we're about to come to the end of sort of successional sowing, aren't we, for most of our summer crop. So what is happening for you going forwards? How do you look at this time of year, and what changes do you make in August compared to, you know, what you have been doing up until this point? What's going to change going forwards?
I think for me, I'm in a position where most of what I can do is kind of done. In the sense that I've got a very limited space. It's 75 square meters, the whole plot, and I've got a shed and four compost bins on there as well. And so I've got 25 raised beds of about 5 foot square. And most of those have now got something growing in them. It will be in there until probably maybe October, perhaps even the first frost in some cases.
Yeah.
Which here could be mid-November, quite reasonably, the way things have been going lately. What I've got at the moment is a couple of empty beds where I've got plans to put things in. So I recently bought some Christmas potatoes. I'm going to do some new potatoes for Christmas this year. And then other than that, it's kind of, I've got things in pots that I'm holding ready for spaces to come available. And I've got an idea in my head. You know, I always write down a plan every year because I'm trying to be as efficient as possible with space. I've got a plan. But the plan changes depending on the circumstances. So, for example, the green sprouting that I've got in there, that has been a waste. It's going to have to come out. That's probably where my Christmas potatoes will now go in their place. And then as the other crops come to their end, so as the beans finish, as the courgettes finish, as the sweet corn's harvested, I've got spring cabbages particularly to go in their place. I've got some spinach and chard to go in their place. I've got a few swedes which I'm going to try transplanting, although I'm not expecting an awful lot out of that. It's just a little experiment this year. Root vegetable. Well, I know they're brassica, but they because they ball up, I treat them as a root vegetable, and they tend not to ball up very well. They don't transplant very well, root vegetables typically. But I'm in a position where I'm ready to go. So I've got plants, they're probably, I don't know, 10, 12 centimeters tall now, about 4 inches, and 3 or 4 inches. And they're ready to go in as soon as there's space for them. So I'm holding them in the modular trays that I use at home. And literally as things come available, as space comes available, I'll mulch it. If I've got enough compost to mulch, if I haven't, I won't. And then I'll plant and then we'll go from there. But for me, it's very much more about this part of the year is harvest. So it's you know, I came home and I said to you on, was it Wednesday night, was it? We were talking.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I'm looking forward to seeing the pictures of these great big marrows you're going home to. I'm like, no, mum will have harvested those. I might find the odd one. I got home, I've got a carrier bag full, and they're still in the fridge, and that needs processing at some point this weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's for me, that's kind of the bit is I'm harvesting, I'm processing, I'm going to be canning. You know, the tomatoes are coming off in like ice cream tubfuls now. The allotment tomatoes have gone way better than the ones in the greenhouse, which is really weird. So far at least, but obviously the greenhouse ones have got a longer season to fruit for me to produce. But the mountain magic at the allotment have been amazing again.
That's great.
Fortunately, there's been no blight to worry about this year so far, but they are literally coming off in ice cream tubfuls now. So that's kind of the thing for me. It's the harvest, it's the processing, and it's just being in a position to move when spaces come available. And that, you know, crops are going to finish earlier this year than normal, I would suggest, you know.
Yeah, because they've been running on you know, maximum revs, haven't they? They've been really revved up. So
everything they need, you know, I'm watering. There's plenty of nutrition in the soil. They've got all the sunlight they need. So they're going to be coming out sooner because they'll have finished. You know, we spoke before, Mike talked about, you know, beans. For every bean you put in the ground, he reckons you get 120 beans back.
Yeah.
Well, once it's produced, it's 120 beans. What's that bean plant going to do? You know, it's not going to produce any more. So that's it. It's going to be done, isn't it? So that I think they're going to be coming out sooner, perhaps. The courgettes might continue going. I can see their nails and they just smack it out.
Yeah, yeah.
But the sweet corn, you know, once that's done, I've got a load of space to fill.
Courgettes are like that guy at work that just loves his job, aren't they?
Yeah, just can't get enough work. Yeah.
Takes all the extra hours, doesn't take his lunch break, and just loves it.
Well, I'll tell you, I went through, I mean, I've probably got, you know, I always go over top on courgette plants. Everyone's like, oh, you only need two. And I'm like, no, I need more than two. So I'm going to want to, I'm going to want to make some chutney. And I use a lot anyway, probably more than some people do. Sort of style of cooking. And I find ways to use them up in any case. And so I've got half a dozen in, I think. And I went round the day before we went on holiday. I went round with my knife and I cut every single courgette off, however big it was.
Yeah.
I cut them all off. And I came back and I've still got courgettes the size of your forearm. 11 days later, where it's mad, mad how quickly they produce. So yeah, so that definitely processing. The other thing I'm looking towards is a bit of winter sowing.
Yeah,
so obviously the spuds, but I'm going to be doing some, I want to do some Crimson King beetroot over winter in the ground. So I'm going to try and get out and sow that this week, next week or so. And I'm also going to do some carrots. I've got some Paris market carrots, which are the little round ones.
Yeah.
I've never done before. Never done those before, but I got the idea from Mike. So I'm going to go and try those just to see if I can get a quick crop in between now and then.
Yeah.
I have already got some dwarf beans in. I've got a bed of dwarf French beans. And I'm tempted to do another one.
Just because sowing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I am. Which is really late, but I've just got this feeling that they're going to germinate really quickly in this heat, isn't, you know, like if I sowed them today, they'd be up by, you know, 3 or 4 days from now. You'd be starting to see some of them showing above the ground. So if that's the case and I can get them to something close to maturity before, I don't know, what, 6 weeks is it? So before the end of September.
Yeah.
The likelihood of frost in this area is really small until November now. So there's a good chance I get a crop off that, a really late crop off that. And given that I think the beans, I've lost the crop of beans in the garden, and that I think the beans potentially finish really early this year, I'm tempted to see if I could just squeeze one in quickly.
Yeah, well, my thoughts on that, I released an episode called Grow More Food all around this idea. And I just think, why not? Because, you know, there's every chance your frost will come early and it won't work out for you. And that's okay.
Yeah. But
if, you know, whatever you think your first frost date is, wherever you live, there's always a chance it's going to come 4 weeks later.
Yeah.
You know, especially the way the climate is at the moment with things, you know, it's so much more variable. And we could literally, places that usually get a frost at, you know, early October, there's every possibility you're not going to get a frost until late November, you know, 6 weeks after you might expect one. So I'm all for just throwing it in and having a go, because you never know, and you might get a load more food out of that what otherwise might have been an empty space in your plot, and you've got nothing to lose apart from a few seeds, really. So I'm a huge advocate for just throwing it in, crossing your fingers and seeing what happens, and critically not being upset if it doesn't work out. So you can catch the second part of that conversation with Alan on Wednesday, and we just ended up running on for well over an hour in the end, and that's why I decided to split this conversation into two parts, and that's also why I'm releasing a interview segment on a Monday. So it's just going to make up two parts of this week's schedule, Monday and Wednesday, and as I said, you can catch the second part of that interview in just 2 days' time. Thank you. This episode of the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast was brought to you by our patrons. You guys are awesome. If you'd like to support the show, there's lots of ways you can do it. The easiest of which is just to like and review it wherever you get our podcasts. You can also tell somebody about it, whether that's on social media or just face-to-face with a friend who you think might benefit from it. But however you support our podcast, we really, really appreciate it. If you'd like to become a patron, please consider doing so by going to patreon.com/self-sufficient hub. However you support the podcast, it's listeners like you that make all of this possible. Thank you ever so much for listening, and I'll speak to you really soon.